The sponsor of this week's episode of the Mobile Dev Memo podcast is Incremental. You've paused advertising and performance didn't change, even though you're using an attribution provider? That's called cannibalization, and it's what happens when you don't measure value. True attribution should focus on value. True attribution measures incrementality, always on. Incremental is the only platform that measures incrementality without requiring any geolift experiments or A/B tests. Used by some of the most sophisticated companies in the world across iOS, Android, TV, CTV, influencers, and even billboards. Join the future of marketing measurement today with Incremental. To learn more, Google Incremental, the future of measurement, or use the link in this episode's description.
The problem is that the distinction needs to be drawn between the competence of the economists and the correctness of their analysis.
Welcome to the Mobile Dev Memo podcast. As always, I am your host, Eric Sufert. My guest today is Tom Fish. Tom, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me on the podcast.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the podcast. So we first met when you were at the Competition and Markets Authority in the UK. You are no longer at the Competition and Markets Authority, or CMA. You are now at a private company, but we first were introduced when you were at the CMA. Please tell us about your background and what you're doing now.
Sure, thanks. Yeah, so I spent most of my career moving around UK government departments and civil service departments. And over the last sort of 5 or 6 years or so, I was positioned in the Competition and Markets Authority, the CMA, really working on projects that were delving into how digital markets work, trying to diagnose any competition problems, and then really trying to advocate for and design a new pro-competition regulatory regime in the UK, and with it giving new powers to the CMA. That piece of legislation made its way into Parliament, and so I sought out a new challenge. I'm now at a startup called Generate, which empowers people to control and access their personal data from online services.
Well, just to clarify, just spell out what that legislation was that you helped to craft.
Yeah, so the piece of legislation which we're hoping will get royal assent or become law in the next month or so is the Digital Markets Competition, and that gives the CMA new powers to oversee a new regulatory regime for the largest tech platforms, where it will be able to introduce strong new rules designating the conduct that they can carry out with their main platforms, and also bring in sort of tough new measures to try and open up competition in some of those key gateway markets.
So that's the DMCCA. So we hear a lot about the DMA, right? I mean, that went into effect recently. The DMCCA, I don't think gets as much airtime in the US. That's not the topic of discussion today, but I think it's worth flagging for the audience. That's something to keep an eye on. It's a competition bill that is working its way through the legislature in the UK now and may become law. I have a post planned about it, but I haven't covered it yet. But anyway, it's an important kind of landmark piece of legislation that I think people should be aware of if they're not. So just kind of a question from, you know, your introduction. You said you were placed in the CMA. Is that how civil service works in the UK? Like, you sign up for the civil service broadly and you kind of get placed in different departments? Or did you apply for that role? Or
I applied for that role. I actually found myself working on secondment at the Treasury Department, and I was working on an independent review of digital markets, which is now widely known as the Furman Review. And it was after that work that I really sort of, it cemented my interest and my passion for digital markets. So that was when I moved to the CMA and sort of sought out work on those sort of key market studies into digital advertising and mobile ecosystems, which followed.
Got it. And so the CMA, from my perspective, was not something that an analyst of the tech ecosystem or the mobile ecosystem would have been aware of or would have been intimately familiar with like 5 years ago, right? But it is now. Part of that is because the CMA has been very active in investigating the digital markets, right? You know, affirmatively. There was the big report that the CMA published, which was how we became acquainted, related to the digital marketplaces, which was, you know, a very expansive report, but also because it took kind of center stage in the Activision Blizzard merger transaction, because the CMA was essentially the competition authority that was investigating that, the sort of the largest one, the one that was in the focus in the press as that transaction worked its way through. And so that's why I have you on today. I think it's really interesting to understand how that dynamic evolved from the point of like 5 years ago, where an analyst might have been aware of what the CMA is, but it wasn't really taking center stage in a lot of these issues, to today, where it does, it very much does, right? And so I'll start with just a big broad question. What is the purpose of the CMA?
Yeah, so I think, put simply, the CMA is the UK's independent competition regulator. This means it's responsible for promoting competitive markets, competitive outcomes in the UK, but also for protecting consumers from unfair trading, unfair practices. And it has a range of tools at its disposal to try and secure these goals. This includes reviewing mergers, strong powers to intervene when markets aren't working well, in its opinion, and also powers to enforce competition and consumer protection law. And as we noted before, it's also soon to gain some pretty strong and flexible new powers to regulate big tech companies. So as a regulator, it can really play a pretty important role in shaping outcomes for the UK economy and society more broadly. But I think, as you're noting and alluding to, it by nature also potentially has ramifications more globally from its actions.
Right. I want to get to that, but would you consider the CMA to be like a one-to-one analog with the US FTC, or are there like kind of fundamental differences between those two departments? I don't know to what extent you're aware of the FTC. I imagine you're probably familiar with it, but do you think they're like they're exact kind of analogs, or are there just kind of some differences that are very, you know, specific to the countries in which they operate?
I won't go into detail and risk exposing my insufficient knowledge of the US system, but I think two answers. I think I tend to sort of view the CMA as perhaps overlapping kind of partially with the FTC and the DOJ in terms of the types of interventions that it makes. But also, I think no regulatory tool is the same. I think the CMA has some unique powers and certainly also some kind of unique flexibility in its powers that other regulators around the world don't have. So I don't think there's a sort of direct map across from the CMA necessarily to any other regulator around the world.
Got it. Okay. And so, okay, so circling back to the question of, you know, CMA sort of having influence on mergers that are not of companies that are not domiciled in the UK, I feel like that was the question I saw being asked the most frequently during the Activision Blizzard merger process, which was, why could the CMA litigate this? That these companies are both headquartered in the United States. They operate in the UK. Is that the reason? I feel like that was the question that was kind of like most commonly asked during that process. And so I'll pose it to you. Why was the CMA litigating that merger? And how did it have the authority to do that? And how could it potentially have blocked it?
Yeah, I think there's different ways of thinking about that question. I think sort of from a purely legal technical perspective, it's a relatively simple one. And it's a simple question around sort of the jurisdictional reach of the CMA's powers. And in this regard, I don't think there's anything necessarily sort of too unique about the CMA. I think the jurisdictional tests that apply to the CMA's merger regime, I guess they're partially more flexible than some of their international counterparts, but essentially they enable them to review any deals that have a material effect on the UK, on competition in the UK, on UK consumers. And this is true even in circumstances where the transaction takes place, say, between two non-UK companies, and where the bulk of those companies' activity occurs in other markets. And I think whether or not we're talking about mergers or sort of markets or antitrust, the main point is that companies don't need to be headquartered in the UK for them to need to respect UK laws and UK institutions. And I think I don't see that as a particularly controversial kind of point of principle to work from. I think having said all that, I think that perhaps the more critical issue is how a country with a relatively small population can influence the global decision-making of such giant firms from other countries. It's a complicated question. I think there's a range of factors at play there. I think the level of influence the CMA has might vary also depending on who you ask.
Well, no, so I mean, I think your answer is not controversial at all, right? It's just, well, if you want to operate in this market, you have to play by our rules. And the UK is an influential market for a number of reasons, right? One is kind of legacy, like the UK has historically been a world leader across a number of different vectors. The second is the size, right? And I think a lot of people don't appreciate this, right? So if you look at the size of the digital market, the EU is about 10%, right? And this has come to the fore in a number of different circumstances, right? One is Meta said, they said this on their earnings call 2 quarters ago, 10% of Facebook's revenue, Facebook, the blue app, not Meta's revenue broadly, but Facebook, the blue app, 10% of the revenue is generated, advertising revenue generated in EU countries, right? So 10%, that's Facebook blue app. It's probably different for Instagram, but that's the point they obviously wanted to make, right? These are very well curated, you know, sort of statements, right? And then Apple, Apple said in the last earnings call, 7% of our App Store revenue is generated in the EU, right? If you look at the size of the UK market, it's not that far behind the size of the overall EU market, despite being what, like 13% or something of it, right? So, you know, and the way I proxied that, I wrote a tweet thread about this earlier in March, right? So you can proxy this from digital advertising spend, right? So 2022, the UK captured just under 30 billion euros in digital advertising spend versus about 49 billion from the EU, right? So it's about, the EU is about 1.7 times the size of the UK from a digital advertising standpoint, you know, comparing a 450 million person single market to a 67 million person market, right? And so, then the UK then therefore is very important. And that's, again, it's a single country relative to the EU is a block, right? But relative to this much larger population, the ratio of revenue or markets, you know, a value to per person per capita is much larger, right? And so it is an influential and important market on that basis.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the importance of the market is disproportionately large compared to the population size. I think the UK is comfortably outside the sort of top 20 countries in terms of population size, but I read that it's sort of the third largest market, for example, in digital advertising. So it definitely enables the CMA and other UK regulators that cover kind of digital issues to punch above their weight, I think. But I think there's probably more to it than that on its own. I think obviously you mentioned the sort of legacy issues as well, but I think as I mentioned earlier, not all regulatory tools are kind of created equally. The CMA does have particularly strong and flexible tools relative to some of its counterparts. It has more flexibility, for example, with which mergers it can look at, and it has extremely strong powers through its market investigation tool, which it's now utilizing with regard to the mobile browser market and cloud gaming. Second, it's led the way, I think, in recent years in examining and diagnosing the issues in digital markets. I think taking, for example, the sort of pretty bold and holistic approach it took into its market studies, starting with digital advertising, when I think we spoke, and also mobile ecosystems. I think this work has really served as a foundation or a bedrock for other jurisdictions to follow. And I think we've seen that in subsequent years. So I think this really just helps to build an understanding and expectation that the CMA, its work is grounded in very kind of robust evidence-based analysis and undertaking. And that means people will perhaps take it seriously from the outset. But being ahead of the pack in this way has also enabled the CMA to take the lead on sort of individual issues that perhaps other regulators around the world don't yet know much about. So that was how the CMA was able to take the lead on the privacy sandbox work.
Right.
And it's also, in my view, why the CMA perhaps had insights into the potential significance of cloud gaming that perhaps other regulators were yet to fully appreciate. And then lastly, I just would make the point that although perhaps it doesn't always work perfectly, the UK does have a pretty strong foundation of independence for its regulators. And this means that the CMA's decisions can't really be easily influenced through political pressure or interference. Now, I'm not saying they can't be influenced at all, but it's not straightforward. And this, I think, sort of slightly neutralizes the army of big tech lobbyists that masquerade as industry bodies and think tanks. And this means that the CMA can sort of take difficult decisions and be able to stand its ground in the face of some of the external pressures that come along.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, Brussels is just, from that respect, it's kind of like a swamp, right? I mean, it's just every person you bump into is wearing like an $8,000 suit and, you know, works in some ambiguous capacity for a big tech company, which I don't think is true in the UK, at least from what I've seen. Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, I don't want to, you know, flatter you too much, but I will. When I spoke to you and your team, you did seem like, I mean, because I speak to, you know, people in various regulatory capacities reasonably frequently and usually just briefing people on these topics, right? Mobile app ecosystem, which is just esoteric as can be. I don't think there's a more esoteric ecosystem or call it economy that's ever existed, right? And partly by design. And, you know, I'd be briefing people in the US Congress and US regulatory agencies and those around the world in the EU and Australia. But the UK's did seem like the savviest, right? And I think that's demonstrated in the fact that the CMA was early to highlight concerns with the privacy sandbox. I mean, that is a complicated system, right? Like that is a complicated proposal, and it requires an immense amount of domain expertise to even really parse superficially, to even really understand what the purpose of it is. And in that regard, I mean, it probably only was the CMA that could do that. The common refrain I hear when I speak to anybody that is involved in regulating the digital markets in the US government, the common refrain I hear is that digital advertising is all rent seeking, right? All of the technology that's involved with it is smoke and mirrors. It's a facade, and it's just designed to charge advertisers more, right? There is no such thing as personalized advertising or like efficient targeting. That's all just sort of made up to allow these companies to charge a premium or something, which just isn't the way that the digital advertising ecosystem works. It's not the way that digital advertising is bought, sold. It's all based on auctions, right? And it feels like, so for in that sense, like I don't think the US regulatory regime is even capable of investigating something as complex as the privacy sandbox, because they fundamentally just, and I'm speaking of very broad generalities here. I'm sure that many people do understand this, but like what I hear most commonly from, you know, representatives of that group is just that, well, digital advertising is all smoke and mirrors, and this is just unnecessary tech that's applied to these systems to allow them to charge more. And so there's just a baseline of understanding that's required to even investigate something like the privacy sandbox. So I feel like in that way, the CMA is probably one of the few regulatory bodies that's capable of doing it.
Yeah, I think that's a good compliment, but a fair one. I think the CMA had a couple of advantages in looking at the privacy sandbox work following the digital advertising market study. I think firstly, it took a really broad, holistic approach to looking at digital advertising. It looked at search and search advertising, social media and display advertising, and all of the ad tech stack all at the same time. And I think this enabled the CMA to get a really good understanding of how it all worked together and how critical sort of data was to bringing it all together. I think secondly, the CMA started to get exposed to the sorts of arguments that were coming from the big tech companies around how they essentially had to do what they were doing because of privacy or security, et cetera. So it was quite some time ago that the CMA started to think about these issues and start to be or attempt to be played off against the Data Protection Authority, the ICO in the UK. So following that study, the CMA and the ICO started working very closely together to try and understand in great detail how their regimes kind of were potentially in conflict and also to understand the sort of strong synergies that they might have between each other. And I think that gave a really good foundation to act really decisively on the privacy sandbox work, whereas perhaps other jurisdictions, they were slightly behind on that thinking.
Yeah, that's interesting. Kind of circling back to the kind of merger interrogation function. So, okay, we talked about like, well, you know, the reason the UK could do this, to answer that question, right? Why can the UK do this? Why can they take a role in this? These companies are not domiciled in the UK. Why can they even issue a decision here? Well, because you have to comply with the laws of the UK if you want to operate in the UK, and they do, right? What would happen if the CMA blocked a merger and the relevant companies went through with it anyway, right? So how could both things happen? What would be required of this new entity in proceeding with the merger, even if the CMA blocked it?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. And I think it's the sort of question that people within regulators ask and think about and try to hypothesize as well. And I think it certainly applies equally to other types of action that the CMA and other regulators might take. So I think it applies to mergers, but also perhaps to kind of enforcement decisions and other sort of interventions. And I think theoretically it can happen. I think that when the CMA make some sort of intervention, whether that's a merger decision or another one, I think the companies have maybe three sort of main choices they can take. They can apply the decision that the CMA has made globally on a sort of voluntary basis. And we've seen some examples of this kind of global first decision making before, such as Google's commitment to make its privacy sandbox commitments on a global basis. And more recently, we've seen Meta making its new data portability tool available globally following its implementation of the DMA. And I think generally, that tends to be the approach with sort of the abandonment of mergers as well. And this kind of global approach, I think, first and foremost, reduces the likelihood of ending up with a real patchwork of regulatory decisions and ending up in a kind of real mess with different versions of the company and the product and the service in different countries. They can also apply regulatory decisions locally and I guess hold out in other jurisdictions until they're pushed. And I think we've seen this with some antitrust enforcement decisions relating to app stores, where the companies sort of apply very narrowly the decision and then carry on what they were doing in all of the other countries. But clearly this kind of approach would be quite challenging in the context of a merger, but not necessarily impossible. They would, I think, theoretically be able to go ahead with the merger globally and then within the UK keep the companies separate. And then lastly, I think if they're not willing to respect the laws and decisions, as we talked about, then they can obviously make the decision to exit the UK. And that really feels like a kind of lose-lose situation for everybody. It would be a pretty messy situation, and I think a bad outcome for UK consumers, which equals a bad outcome for the CMA. And obviously the CMA would come under pretty significant pressure from various sources to avoid that outcome. So, yeah, I think it would be bound to sort of put some real stress on the question of independence that I mentioned. But I think ultimately this would be, I think it would be a very expensive game of chicken for the companies to try and play. And it's not a one-shot game either. So if there is a positive to take from the Microsoft Activision merger for UK consumers, I think it's that it's at least shown the world, it's shown the big tech companies that the CMA is not necessarily likely to blink first. So in future, they might come forward with promising remedies to competition concerns at earlier stage, which I think would be a good outcome.
Well, that felt also like there was a back and forth there, right? I mean, they had like an open line of communication. The CMA had concerns, that Microsoft addressed them, and it went through, right? So that seems like a productive process that led to a positive outcome. Am I interpreting that correctly?
I think there are very, very strong and different views on all of those points. I think most that were close to it, and I wasn't close to it, I think most would agree that the process was actually quite messy. I think there were some pretty novel uses of the legal framework to eventually approve the merger with the updated remedies. But I'm of the view that it was a positive outcome and that the UK secured additional beneficial remedies from Microsoft that otherwise weren't achieved by the European Commission and others. So I think it was a good outcome. I'm not sure it necessarily left sort of Microsoft in a very good light in terms of the way they spoke out publicly about the CMA and the UK economy. But perhaps, as I say, for future mergers, perhaps Microsoft might be more forthcoming with those kinds of remedies in the first instance, rather than thinking that the CMA could be bullied.
Okay. One thing I want to ask you about is, I remember there was a sort of drumbeat of decisions from competition authorities around the world. I remember one in particular, Chile, you know, announced, hey, we approve this merger, right? So do competition authorities tend to take into account the decisions of other competition authorities when they're deciding for their own jurisdiction? Like, is there any sense of momentum or harmonization that goes into the decisions that any one authority would make?
I think this is a pretty straightforward yes. And I think they are quite transparent about this. I think the cooperation between the international agencies and regulators has definitely been increasing over time in response to the global nature of digital markets. And I think this is a good thing for all involved. I think most people recognize and agree that it's helpful to minimize the divergence between different jurisdictions where possible, but also to try and align the kind of the process and the timing of these decisions, which I think must be to the benefit of the companies involved. But equally, I would expect the CMA and the European Commission and the FTC, DOJ or others, I think, would all be keen to stress that they are also willing to diverge and take different path where perhaps the facts of the case look different in their own jurisdiction. So perhaps the sort of avoiding divergence isn't necessarily the end goal in itself, but I think they certainly work hard to achieve it. Overall, I'd say businesses shouldn't underestimate the extent to which international regulators really do speak to each other a lot and share intelligence and insights and try to line up in terms of timing and of announcements and things like that.
Okay, so we talked about the what and we talked about the how. I want to talk about the why. So why are we seeing so much activity related to the, and let me know also if I'm wrong and I'm just aware of it more now, or these cases are just more high profile so they make the news more now, but the reality is like the same sort of level of regulatory investigation is kind of consistent with the baseline, with the ongoing level of investigations. But why are we seeing more of this over time? Why has competition regulation in the digital ecosystem, or just general regulatory interest in the digital ecosystem increased over time? Why is that the case?
I think it's an interesting one. There's definitely something there, but I think it's perhaps the perception of it is slightly exaggerated. I think naturally the firms that tend to be perhaps in the firing line for some of these interventions, they are able to draw attention to those cases, to those actions very significantly, largely as a result of the kind of vast lobbying power that, but also because of the nature and universality of the services that they provide. People don't tend to be quite as interested in a fine for a pharmaceutical firm or maybe a review of a shipping merger or something. So generally, these things tend to catch the news, whereas perhaps other things don't. But if you're asking me, have we sort of seen an uptick in the scrutiny of big tech acquisitions, for example, over the last 5 years or so, then I would say yes, we have. But that's not because there's some sudden sort of surge now. It's actually because there was simply no scrutiny of them before whatsoever, literally none at all. And that was the problem that I believe is now being addressed. But even now in practice, I think that if you look at the numbers for the UK, at least, the CMA still intervenes in a very tiny proportion of all mergers. And it's, I think, pretty rare that the CMA intervenes or blocks a merger in cases where all of the other agencies were completely happy with them. I saw some numbers in an article recently for perhaps the previous year for the CMA. And I think of tens of thousands of mergers that it had jurisdiction over, I think it perhaps did an initial screening of 500, 600, 700 of them, of which just 6 were blocked or abandoned in that year as a result of its scrutiny. So really the kind of the overall proportion of mergers and acquisitions that the CMA is intervening on and preventing is extremely small. So yeah, I think there is a perception of a big shift in policy, but in practice, the numbers show it's much more subtle than that.
Talk to me about the lack of scrutiny, the historical lack of scrutiny. Why do you think that was? Did these companies just weren't as influential, or was it something else? Was it a different sort of atmosphere within these regulatory, you know, agencies? Why do you feel like they got no scrutiny prior to this recent moment?
I think that's a really hard question for me to answer, having not been around at the time. But I think it probably boils down to a lack of understanding, real detailed understanding at that time of how these businesses were working, what their strategy was, what their kind of business model was. And the companies were buying completely unknown companies that sort of had no sort of revenue to speak of. And so perhaps with more traditional approaches to merger assessments, they seem perhaps non-problematic. And so I think over the last few years, we've seen a slight adaptation, refresh of how the authorities look at mergers from big tech companies. But generally speaking, I think hindsight's obviously a wonderful, wonderful thing, but largely I think it just stemmed from a lack of appreciation for how these businesses were operating.
Got it. And that came to the fore with, I don't know, with scandals, I guess. Is that right? Like that appreciation for how they operate?
I think actually just from really kind of careful study and scrutiny by a range of different regulators all around the world, really. I think over the last 5 or 6 years, I think there's just been a lot of learning going on, really sort of evidence gathering, careful scrutiny, determination to understand the business models of these companies, not to sort of treat them with a broad brush, but to understand each individual one and how their ecosystems work together. And I think that's what's enabling regulators now to understand perhaps which acquisitions might be the ones that they need to look out for.
Yeah, interesting. So just as a function of these companies becoming bigger and becoming more of a central part of our social lives, they attracted more scrutiny and regulators became more familiar with how they operate. Is that roughly right?
Yeah, I guess also time did provide a pretty strong hindsight. So over time, the acquisitions that they had made all started to reveal themselves as very large, powerful services that perhaps could have turned out to be useful competitors. And Instagram's an easy example to call upon. But at the time, perhaps not many people would have expected it to grow into what it has become. But once people could see the potential that it had, I think that's when questions started to get asked and more focus started to get placed on the regulators' decisions from the past.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just share my opinion on that. topic specifically, but I mean, I feel like it's easy to say, well, Instagram became big, therefore it always would have become big, whether Facebook acquired it or not. And I feel like, well, plugging into Facebook's advertising infrastructure probably gave it a pretty big advantage in becoming big, right? And, you know, if you look at the sentiment around that acquisition at the time, people thought Zuckerberg had lost his mind. I mean, you're paying how much for this small company? It's got how many employees? It's got how many users? So I don't think by any stretch people saw that as a foregone conclusion of success. In being given the benefit of one of the most sophisticated advertising machines that has existed in all time, like it grew into something big and powerful. But you know, I don't want to divert our discussion to that topic, because I think that could just be a landmine.
I agree. I'll just follow up briefly. I think I'd probably be inclined to agree on that example. I don't think it's clear cut, and if you look at the information available at the time, it wasn't obvious. It wasn't an obvious glaring error, though perhaps the price was something that should have drawn suspicion. I think a better example that perhaps I should have drawn on was Google's acquisition of DoubleClick, which I think people did try to raise concerns about at the time. And I think perhaps in hindsight, that might be one that a different decision should have been reached on.
Well, that is very different, because the DOJ investigated it, right? So there were, just by definition, there were concerns. Right. That feels like you could make the case. And, you know, just with the benefit of hindsight, I wrote up a big thing about the DOJ's investigation of Google, the antitrust investigation of Google. One of them, the one related to ad tech and the combining the demand side with the supply side with the exchange. So anyway, I wrote that up and, you know, kind of went through the history of that. And yet there was an investigation. I mean, by definition, it raised some eyebrows. Okay, I want to take the conversation into more of like what it's like to work at one of these competition authorities. So I think it feels like there's probably like a very strong culture within these organizations. So what does success look like, right? If you would, you know, walk into the CMA or, you know, and again, I know you're not totally familiar, but I imagine you have a sense of, you walked into the FTC, you have these people, I imagine, they're very committed to what they do, right? They join these organizations for a reason. They felt compelled. It's public service, right? You know, they probably not, I can't speak to the UK, but in the US, they're probably not doing it for the money, right? And you tap somebody on the shoulder and you said, what does success look like? What would happen for you to feel like you were successful in your job at the end of the year, at the end of the decade? What would that be? What would they say?
I think this is perhaps, in my view, one area where all global regulators, but the CMA included, maybe fall a little short, because I don't think they necessarily have a kind of clear overarching vision for what they want the world to look like, for what they're working towards. I think my experience of working in regulators, not just the CMA, is that there tends to be a sort of slightly more piecemeal approach. Well, I think regulators are generally set up to work on a case-by-case basis. That's not really their fault. It's in their design. And it's not really necessarily conducive to building an overarching vision for what you want the world to look like. And I think this was particularly pertinent, in my view, in terms of how the CMA was thinking about the online ad ecosystem. I never felt that we really had a clear kind of vision for what we wanted a healthy, thriving, sustainable online ad ecosystem to look like. Perhaps instead, success was judged on how well we did in a particular project or case or intervention. Whereas perhaps on reflection, I think we should have been thinking, okay, well, how do we ensure sustainability of independent media and journalism? What's the role of ad blocker technology? How do we want people to consent to targeting without spoiling their experience? And I think all of these big, tricky questions, actually, I think you need the ability to look at these questions in the round rather than kind of judging success on a case-by-case approach. And that's tricky. I'm not saying the CMA or other regulators don't have a kind of effective strategy, or they don't think carefully about how the decisions link together. But I think it's one area where there is perhaps kind of room for improvement, and that might be in the way that they're designed rather than the way that they're run.
Can you expand on that? What could be done? Like, how does that change?
I think there's a kind of real pressure on regulators like the CMA to deliver clear outcomes that they can report back to Parliament, where they're accountable for, but also to the wider public. I think the work to build a vision and a strategy for the world that you want to create, what success looks like, I think that's a hard job and it takes time and perhaps a lot of resource and might not immediately deliver clear results. So I think it's perhaps not a sort of headline grabbing piece of work to do, but I think if it's given the room and the breathing space to think about these things over the long term, to really invest in long-term thinking and horizon scanning, for example, then the collection of cases and work that it brings going forwards can hopefully sum together to be greater than some of their parts. And I think, to me, sometimes the actions that the CMA and the European Commission and others take often appear, from the outside at least, to be looked at on a case-by-case basis.
Got it. What do you think competition authorities generally do well when it comes to digital markets? And what do you think they do poorly? And you're no longer at the CMA. If they asked you to come, hey, can you come advise us? Or you come give us your feedback. What are we doing poorly? What would you say? And not just the CMA, but just broadly regulatory agencies. Like, what do they get? What do they do well? And what do they get when it comes to digital markets? And sort of like, what are they off the mark on? How could they improve? How could they become better at pursuing that sort of success outcome that we talked about just before?
I perhaps sort of jumped ahead and partially answered or anticipated this question with my previous answer. So I will, if you'll indulge me, go slightly narrower and more specific with my answer to this one. So really, I think all competition authorities around the world have yet to really appreciate the importance of data portability in their attempts to create a thriving online ecosystem. And really, this is an issue I became really passionate about whilst working at the CMA. And it's one reason really why I was motivated to sort of go out into the real world and try and affect real change on my own. And this is, I think, because there is an issue that's absolutely core, in my view, to almost all of the competition challenges we see online. And that's the zero price floor that's in place in most of the major platform markets. So without price competition, it's just simply not feasible for new entrants to get a foothold in the market. And I think so many other competition and consumer concerns all sort of flow from this issue. And to date, I don't think regulators have really honed in enough on this issue. And I don't think they, as a result, they've been sufficiently motivated to really try and drive forward initiatives around data portability, even using the existing toolkit that they have. I believe that as people start to gain real effective access to and control over their data, they'll start to have real choices. And this is the moment when we'll start to see people getting paid in some way for searching the web, or if they're doom scrolling on social media or something. And I think that's the point that we'll sort of forget the kind of pay or okay model that we're seeing coming through now. And maybe within sort of next 5 years or so, we might see this flipped. We might see platforms rewarding people that consent rather than needing to pay to try and gain their own privacy. So really, this is just a kind of a plug for the issue that I'm most passionate about. I think if regulators start to place more emphasis on data portability solutions and interventions, then I think we will start seeing much more transformative change coming through in the way that digital markets operate.
Got it. How does someone get that job, right? So I imagine it's like a really interesting job, like on a day-to-day basis. There's probably a lot of like intellectual stimulation working here. So someone studying in college right now, they're listening to this podcast. What do they do? How do they get a job at the CMA? What do they study? What's the pathway to joining a competition regulator?
There are such a diverse range of backgrounds and skills and expertise at the CMA. I think the most important thing that I looked for when I was hiring whilst I was there was people that just evidently had a kind of a passion and an interest in some of the topics that we were looking into. And I perhaps that's a sort of easy answer and probably applicable to all organizations. But we had people there doing kind of project management roles that could have really any background whatsoever. There was kind of economists, lawyers, very technically gifted statisticians and computer scientists and technologists. And so really there was no kind of skill background or sort of expertise that wasn't useful. The critical thing that set people apart in my view at the CMA was how passionate everyone was, how dedicated people were. And they really all shared a kind of a common interest or motivation for making a difference. And I think that really is the key, because as you said earlier, it's not, you aren't motivated to go and work at a place like the CMA if you want to get rich quick. You have to find your pleasures in other ways. And I think really that's how it attracts the right people, because it's the people that are motivated to make a positive difference.
Tom, I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today. I appreciate you sharing your insight and your wisdom here. How can people find you on the internet? How can they connect with you? How can they learn more about you, about the CMA, about what you're doing now? How can they just get more acquainted with you?
Feel free to look me up on LinkedIn, Tom Fish. Otherwise, look up the Coalition for Online Data Empowerment, which is a trade association which I run for my sector.
Tom Fish, thank you very much.